Welcome, everybody. It's the Market Sniper, and I'm delighted to have Professor Richard Werner. For those of you that don't know, Richard is the author of now almost, I'm going to describe it as a cult classic, Princes of the Yen. It's a best-selling book. He's described as a German development economist, my apologies. He spent immense time researching this. It is deemed highly, highly, highly detailed. And more importantly, for those of you that think, well, Japan, long way away, it may not be of such interest to me. I live in America, UK. It's also a template in many, many ways of how the underworld dealings of central banking take place and how many of the things that went on during the boom period of Japan, the pause, and then the subsequent low growth period in Japan. Richard, welcome to the program. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So for people that have maybe not seen the documentary or read the book, what would be the five salient bullet points, I suppose you'd say, that were really big tells of how things were run in the post-war Japan into the 80s and 90s?
Well, one thing that's very fundamental, and I think thanks to the experience of the last 3 years, a lot more people have caught on to this, is, you know, when you go to Japan, I mean, they do tell you, well, it's a different culture, different society, so you have to learn some of the cultural rules. And so very early on, when I was a student in Japan, I was told, well, there's one thing that's very different in Japan. You see, in Japan, there's not one truth, then two truths. What do you mean, two truths? Well, you see, if you are in a formal setting, in a formal meeting, or there's a formal press conference or announcement or a government statement, anything formal, well, that is the official truth. And there's a Japanese name for that. Tatemae, which means the front, the facade of the building, you know, the outer appearance, the official truth. But everyone does cherish the real truth, which is called hone, the actual inside truth, the inner truth, the deeper truth. And that one you will find out in Japan in informal meetings. And anything after sort of 6 o'clock is considered off the record. And that's why a lot of things happen in Japan after 6 o'clock. There's lots of dinner meetings because people can talk straight. They dispense with all the formality. They just totally ignore the official truths and official narratives. They talk straight. And nobody will be quoted. Nobody will be blamed for, oh, but he said this and he should have stuck to the official. Sorry, no. It's all off the record and everyone speaks straight. And that was so eye-opening to me, of course, as a student. First of all, I mean, the initial slant you get from the Japan experts was, oh, you see, Japan is a very dishonest society. You know, they have two truths. I mean, this is dishonest. But because you start to realize, well, this is happening everywhere in the world. Japan is more honest by making it explicit and by everyone actually after hours than speaking straight and ignoring the official stories. So that was a great lesson. That applies to everything. And so it applies to economics. It applies to monetary policies, government policies. And so, of course, the official narrative that we've learned about Japan has been that it's sort of, in fact, you know, perhaps we start with the very clearly American version of this narrative, which became increasingly clear from the late 60s throughout the 70s, namely, oh, the Japanese economy has problems because it is just too much focus on exports and domestic demand is not doing very well. And the poor Japanese, actually, they're suffering from this. They can't enjoy consumption. Domestic demand is so crippled and suppressed. And that's just all this government intervention and distortion that the whole economy is very inefficient. And so literally, the Americans...
They're saving too much, Richard.
Yes,
they haven't got big enough revolving credit.
Easy to forget, because when you do empirical research, quickly you realize that savings variables have no explanatory power for anything whatsoever. They're ex post counting identities that have no behavioral implications. That's why any empirical researcher doesn't talk about savings, but you're right. Part of the official narrative is the saving, excess savings. And all right. So these current account surpluses, which is another way of saying, external savings and excess savings, all this is such a big distortion, which is burdening the Japanese society. And America wanted to liberate the Japanese people from this burden and from these misallocations of resources. And literally in these negotiations with Japan, would argue that, look, your economy could do much better if you just deregulated, liberalized, privatized, and let market forces play a bigger role. And then you have domestic demand expansion, and we have a current account balance, and everything will be fine. Now, you have to imagine this is after Japan had more than two decades of double-digit economic growth, rising rapidly after the Second World War to become one of the top industrialized powers by the late 60s, overtaking Germany and becoming the number two economic power in the world by GDP. And then the Americans having the gall to tell them, oh, your economy is actually not doing so well. We know how it can do better. You can do much better by deregulating, liberalizing, privatizing. But of course, the truth of the matter was the U.S. wanted to stop this juggernaut. Japan had been decimating one U.S. industry after another. It was shipbuilding, steel, automobiles, then electronics. And so the U.S. was very keen to stop that. But they were selling it as attempts to help Japan to be even more competitive and even more successful, which was hard to believe for the Japanese. So all these attempts didn't work. There's a structural impediments initiative, all these structural rigidities that need to be changed. They did have an impact. I mean, Japan from the 70s started to do what it was told by the masters. Remember, there's U.S. troops in Japan, and Japanese elite after 45 had made a deal that the Americans are calling the shots, and the Americans wanted changes, so they got their changes. Japan deregulated, liberalized.
If I can, sorry, Richard, break your flow. So many people, just also for our viewers who just don't have your level of take, don't realize that parts of losing the war and, of course, being destroyed infrastructurally, they also lost their independence on economic determination to a large degree politically. Could you just give us a small segment on how they almost had to be compliant to a U.S. diktat post 45? How was it that, okay, you're in charge of your country officially again now, but here's the rules? Can you cover that a little as well, please?
Yes. Well, in fact, it's probably best and quite efficient if we do this both for Japan and Germany at the same time. First of all, the contrast. So when the German leadership was either killed, executed as criminals or in prison as war criminals, for instance, the minister in charge of the war economy in Germany being in Spandau prison in Berlin. During that time in the 60s, when Albert Speer was in prison and in Germany as a war criminal, his Japanese wartime colleague, who was the minister of the war economy in Japan, was prime minister of Japan.
Unbelievable, yeah.
So that gives you an idea of the differences. In other words, in Japan, the wartime elite was almost entirely left intact and a deal was made. And the deal was, okay, guys, you can continue, but, we call the shots and you better do what we say. And it's thanks to our grace that, we're not executing you. Look at Germany. Or you're not in prison. Look at Germany. That's the basis. In Germany, probably because it's in Europe, U.S., occupation was very careful to do everything legally. So the occupation statutes from 1945 defined the powers of the occupation powers, and the Western Allied powers insisting on these statutes, particularly the UK and the US, according to these statutes, can almost do anything in Germany, seizing assets, seizing people. And there's no democratic accountability. And according to the international laws, you know, concerning warfare and occupation of territories, of course, when a country or a territory is occupied, the constitution is suspended, and you get basically what's called a basic law, which is a temporary occupation time legal framework. And that's what Germany received. They've got a basic law as the constitution is suspended. And quite immediately, of course, the U.S. moved a lot of its military and secret service leaders into and apparatus, you know, the whole machinery into Germany, where they've been installed ever since. And of course, they have no incentive to change the status, which is likely a big reason why there's no peace treaty with Germany. So the state of war continues technically, and Germany, because it's still occupied, it is still under U.S. And partly U.K. occupation. And the German government is merely the occupation administration. Now, that explains a lot in what's going on, particularly now, currently, with the German government. I mean, can we call it a government? Implementing policies that are highly destructive of Germany, German society, German economy. It's because they're not, of course, a sort of grassroots government that's put in place by the people representing the sovereign. It is representing the occupation powers. Now, in Japan, the situation was different also legally, because the U.S. occupation, they argued, well, we have to give them a constitution, there should be a peace treaty, and so they wanted to change that status quo and make Japan a sovereign nation again, at least on paper. Yes. So Japan received this constitution, which was U.S. written, and the U.S. very soon regretted that, all that, including the content of the constitution.
What freedom?
It gave Japan a very democratic system, including it was hardwired to be a peaceful nation that has no army, no navy, no military whatsoever. It's in Article 8 of the Constitution. Now, let's see what YouTube makes with this, because in Japan, this is a total taboo topic. You mustn't mention Article 8 of the Constitution of the country, because everyone, every child can see it's a lie. They're not even sticking to their constitution. Japan, of course, has an army, has a navy, has a big military, because a few years later, America decided, whoops, actually, we'd like them to rearm. And they did it against the Constitution. There was a so-called U.S.-Japan peace treaty in the 60s, which was all about rearming Japan, and the population, it was like, I don't know, 90% plus against it, fiercely against it, because they thought, okay, we have that Constitution, don't take it away from us again. It is a good idea. We have no army. That's great. We want that to continue. We want to be peaceful. And they are a very peaceful people, for the moment. So,
they are. If I can come in and give you a chance to take a bit of breath as well. Have they not recently, with the escalation of the U.S.-China, almost accelerated the encouragement of Japan to militarize as a sort of proxy ally, even though I'd call it slave ally, to counterbalance the fact that America doesn't it's quite a difficult thing to sustain a force in the South China Sea area generally. So bring in that modernized element too, if you can.
Yes, of course. And so the U.S. has continued to ask for more militarization, but the Japanese population has always been against that. And there have been fierce and long-standing, I mean, months and months and years of demonstrations against that peace treaty before and after, and even during the signing of that peace treaty. You know how that was signed? Because the majority of parliamentarians, members of parliament in Tokyo, were against it, because they also knew that, I mean, everyone in the population virtually was against it. So how could the members of parliament be for it? So the majority was against it. You know what they did? So the ruling elite, which had this deal with the Americans, it was, in fact, it was this Albert Speer of wartime era that was prime minister still at the time, Kishi, it was his name, Nobusuke Kishi. And he had this debate in parliament where he said, no, we're going to sign this now. And then arguments get heated. I mean, you probably, and your viewers will probably have seen some of the scenes of the Taiwanese parliament sometimes where parliamentarians get slightly physical. I mean, it's, you know, it's sort of within reason, I guess, just slapping each other. But it's not clear whether this happened or not, because the Japanese really are not prone to doing this at all. So I suspect it did not happen. But Kishi and his party claimed, the opposition is staging a riot in parliament, which was a trumped up charge. They called the police into parliament to remove the opposition and everyone who was not willing to vote for the treaty. Of course, the speaker refused to hold the vote. The speaker was physically carried into parliament and was forced to now open the session for the vote and hold the vote with only those present who were in favor of signing this treaty with America. That's how it was
democracy
forced through. Exactly, that's democracy in action. So extremely dramatic events and traumatic for Japan, because they know, everyone knows, that is what happened to us. That's what they've done to us, just to get America's will. And it's been like that ever since, basically. So you have a political elite that knows we have to do what America says, but officially we're a sovereign nation. whereas in Germany, you don't have the official part. You know, but Germany is officially not a sovereign nation. It is a pretense, thin veneer they put on. If you poke it a little bit, they will admit, yeah, well, actually, yeah, the occupation statutes are still on the books. We're not sovereign. There's no peace treaty. Japan got a peace treaty, you know. Germany didn't.
The model seems to comply with their two truths, though, doesn't it? It seems to comply with the two truths.
Oh, yeah, of course it does.
Until we signed this, well, it was a gun to the head. Yeah.
Yes, everything does. But the end result is the same for both Germany and Japan. They're under U.S. Under U.S. Management, and they're doing what America says. In the details, the difference is how this was implemented. And so there we are. So this is sort of the background. So when the U.S. said, no, we're serious, we are serious, you have to change your economic system, you have to increase domestic demand, you have to become, you know, less export-oriented and more domestic demand-focused, the Japanese government complied. They deregulated, liberalized. More than 10,000 regulations were scrapped throughout all the industries. Cartels, there used to be over 1,000 cartels, which are official exemptions from the anti-monopoly law, they were scrapped. Japan complied. But of course, what the Americans had promised, that this would result in more economic growth, was nowhere to be seen. Quite the opposite. As Japan did all that, economic growth continued to decline, but it still wasn't enough for the Americans. It seems they wanted to really instill this idea that the Japanese system, because most people still knew that the system works and is great and is effective, but is now laboring under American sort of pressure to change it. They wanted to drive home the point that no, this system doesn't work. And so apparently they came up with another plan, which had to do with the central bank. And that's where the whole story of, the main story of Princes of the Yen comes in. It was announced in the 80s by central bankers that there's a plan now to change Japan's economic structure fundamentally, a fundamental transformation of the economic structure. And they talked about this plan. It was known as the Maekawa plan, Maekawa being one of the heads of the Bank of Japan. And it says that, you know, all these things will happen: deregulation, liberalization, privatization, shifting from export demand to domestic demand, and will be the powers of the finance ministry will be reduced. The central bank has to be independent. It's all written there. What it doesn't say is, okay, how are you going to do this? That's the intriguing bit. There's only one sentence that also governor of the central bank, Miyano, who was at the time governor of the central bank, said, namely, in order to implement this, monetary policy would have to be used flexibly. And that's what they did. So they used monetary policy very flexibly. Because in the 80s, people, you know, watched the result, namely, wow, property is doing really well. Property prices, wow, they're really rising. Everyone wants to get in on it. And it wasn't very hard to get a loan to buy property in Japan in the 80s. In fact, turns out that the bankers were calling up people, even those that had no account at the bank, and said, look, we think you have enough assets. You have some wealth. We found a property for you. We'll give you the loan. We've done the calculations. Here's the property. Just sign here. You get the money. And we think next year you'll make X in profits. So this is how aggressively the banks were pushing, were pushing their property loans. And so there's this property bubble. And
that parallel, if I can come in on that as well, it's very American salesmanship, isn't it? And it does parallel very much with the subsequent ninja loans that, of course, were going to welfare checks. And this just raises the question, we're talking very much UK, America hegemony, but it does feel like the political Zionism of warmongery and central banking pump and dump scheme, you know, and monetary system is actually that transnational disease that was permeating here. Sometimes I feel we nationalize these things while it's almost this force, if we can. And you're welcome to refer to that as well, if you agree. I mean, what's your comment to that?
Well, I found it sufficient. I mean, I'm a very frequent user of Occam's razor. I find it sufficient to use the simplest explanation and to explain what's going on the level of implementation of policies. Central banks are the key tool. They move the economy, macroeconomy, all the variables. And the central banks seem to have had this agenda. And you can actually explain that because it does increase their power.
Of course. They're synchronized.
And there is this theory of bureaucracy, which says that every bureaucracy will strive to increase their powers, and that leads to certain mechanics and results. Well, it does apply to central banks. I've identified a further feature there, namely, that is, we suffer from regulatory moral hazard. The key regulators are the central banks, and whenever they mess up and we have another crisis, they get more power.
That's right.
So therefore, they have no incentive to avoid crises. They do really well out of crises. In fact, it started in the 70s when there was this significant inflation. And the central banks and their hired economists and their research departments quite successfully argued somehow that, oh, this inflation was because central banks were not independent enough. They're doing what governments say. There was the oil shock, and therefore the central banks were forced to print more money. And therefore, you know, because the governments wanted to respond to the oil shock, higher prices. And so central banks need to be independent from these governments. Now, that's a complete distortion of the fact from start to finish. This is not what happened in the 70s. And actually, we might as well start with that because inflation is a topic, of course, you know, since 21. But also the parallels to today and the, you know, the inflation since 2021 and the 70s, that's a fascinating comparison because we're being told the same story. I mean, you know, in the 70s, we all know, we seem to know it was an oil shock inflation. There was there was a war in the Middle East. You know, people forget, why was there an OPEC oil embargo? Okay, there's a war in the Middle East. And the Arab nations wanted to punish Europe and America. And so they actually imposed an oil embargo and refused to sell oil to Europe and America. I mean, they did sell some oil, but, you know, they reduced quantities and all that. And they pushed up the oil price. And that's why we had this inflation. First round in 73. There was a second round end of the 70s. And that explains what happened. Now, this is the tatemae, the official narrative. And it's totally, It's totally not true. It's absolutely not true. I checked it with the data. The inflation, of course, started earlier. And in many countries, it peaked already. It peaked already before the war in the Middle East and before the first OPEC oil embargo. And right. Then the inflation comes down. And when did the oil price actually rise? Because in many countries, in like Germany, inflation peaked in the, I mean, there's the second peak in the second half, and in towards the end of the 70s, 78, 79. But the first part, it peaked in initially in June 73, and then started to come down. So the oil price only rose significantly in January 74. Suddenly, we have quadrupled. Now, it turns out that it was quadrupled when Henry Kissinger arm-twisted the Saudi Arabian oil minister to quadruple the oil price, because the Saudis were reluctant. Said, no, we're not going to quadruple the oil price. Everyone will look at us and will be mad with us, and we're not going to do this. No, you have to do this. America forced Saudi Arabia. Now, it's clear from the record, America forced Saudi Arabia to quadruple the oil price. Now, why was that? And to understand that, one needs to see what's really behind all that. And that, of course, it all has to do with the monetary system and the US dollar. Yeah. So the system that we had, the Bretton Woods system, was the dollar was at the center and all the major currencies were in a fixed exchange rate to the US dollar.
Right.
The D-mark, the yen, and so on. And the dollar itself could be, in theory, exchanged into gold at the official rate. What was it? $38.
That's right. This was just for everyone else. It was Vietnam, post-Vietnam, and the Nixon of 71 key point.
Now, 71 was the turning point. So the system was in place from 46 until August 71. But what happened just before 71, and this basically signaled the end of the system. The system came under strain because with the Americans, with the dollar at the center of this and fixed exchange rates, there was a great opportunity for America, namely to just print dollars and go and buy the world. That's exactly what they did. So America abused its power of being the world currency by massively expanding the money supply, and they bought up assets in Europe, all the European countries, land, property, castles, companies. But also in other countries, Japan, anywhere, where the, you know, countries were a member of this fixed exchange rate system. Now, most countries had to shut up and be quiet because there were U.S. troops in the country. But there was one country that considered itself a major country that was not U.S. occupied and was not member of NATO, and that was France. And the French started to get really annoyed by this. These Americans, and they saw the facts, the Americans just printing dollars and buying our French companies, our French land, our buildings. They're just printing money and buying it.
So they also take gold back.
Well, so then, I mean, there was even a book written, Le Défi Américain, against this. And so the leadership in France thought about, okay, what can we do? And there is one thing they could do, and that was, well, France ended up with all these U.S. dollars. So what do you do with the dollars? And they could exchange them into gold. And that's what France increasingly did from 68 roughly onwards. And there's some dramatic scenes where France sends Navy ships to Manhattan. You know, imagine this French big military Navy ship moving into Manhattan, docking, and the captain and the sailors getting out and walking to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York under instruction to bring
French gold. Get all stuff.
Because, of course, the initial reaction by the Americans was, oh, you can change into gold. It's not a problem. So the French exchanged the gold. And then it turned out the gold was held in custody by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And the French said, well, hang on. That's not exactly what we meant when we said we exchange our dollars into gold, because the U.S. were going to keep that gold. And so the French had to literally send the aircraft carrier and say, no, we are actually taking the gold. Now, when that happened, it was clear to the Americans, okay, this system is moving towards its end phase, and we have to work on the introduction of the new system. And so the dramatic turning point was 15th of August, 1971, when Richard Nixon held his television announcement speech saying that he was going to move against the bad speculators that are attacking the U.S. dollar, and I'm going to move now to protect the U.S. dollar, and therefore I'm temporarily suspending the convertibility of the dollar to gold. Yeah. Temporarily.
Like temporary tax, isn't it? It's the misnomer.
Yeah, exactly. When a politician says temporary. Okay, so that's when the United States of America defaulted on its international obligations. It was a default because the system was based on that promise that the U.S. would exchange all the dollars it created into gold on demand, because only central banks can demand it. When the French central bank did demand it, did we say we exchanged the gold? We've just suspended convertibility. So they defaulted. That was a major U.S. default. Because what happens that moment? I mean, he was talking, a politician talking about defending the U.S. dollar, when the truth is, that moment, or the next moment when the speech is over, the U.S. dollar would collapse.
Yeah.
Fall and fall and fall. So the U.S. leadership adopted a two-pronged strategy. Number one, it was going to do something where it was using its imperial power over all the countries it had military and political control over to shore up the dollar. Namely, it instructed, and then through the Fed, it instructed the central banks of all these countries to print their own currency like crazy. So that, in relative terms, you know, these currencies would not strengthen so much, and the dollar weakness would not be so visible.
Yeah.
And to put it very briefly, that is actually why we had this inflation in the 70s. Because the Fed instructed the whole world that was part of the system that was now being changed, and they defaulted in America, just go out and print money. We instruct you to, in order to make the collapse of the dollar less dramatic.
Isn't it the octopus that's behind all central banks, that's, you know, for which the Fed was the main tentacle? Of course, we nationalize it and say it's America, but they said we're going to have a crisis in that zone. We need all the others to devalue by a similar rate to catch up. And it's almost, there's an octopus head behind all of this, Richard. Was that too conspiratorial for you in terms of this coordination of central
banks? Yes. I mean, that's too conspiratorial. It's unnecessary. Because, you know, as I said, I mean, simple explanations are sufficient. What we have is central banks. There is a hierarchy. And it is a fact that the Federal Reserve is influential over other central banks. And that's because of the U.S. military power, which is apparent. Everyone knows this. The U.S. is heading NATO and various military alliances across the globe in its sphere of influence. So these are the facts, and that is sufficient to explain what's going on, actually. And that should give us hope that we can actually do something about it, and more people should know about this. So that was actually only the first step.
And then the Petrodollar, Kissinger.
So then the next step was, how can we, in the long run, shore up the dollar? And the analysis was, well, the problem was the U.S. trade deficits and current account deficits. And the main surplus countries, of course, at the time were Germany and Japan. The fact was the Japanese and the Germans just could not see enough.
Both famously
U.S. goods that they wanted to buy. They could not see enough U.S. goods. They were attracting services attractive enough for Japan and Germany to buy. Therefore, they were always selling more than they were buying for America, hence current account surpluses there, and America had these huge deficits. So the Americans figured, okay, if we can't provide enough for them, well, what do they need? Oh, they need oil. Yeah. And so that's when American troops moved into Saudi Arabia. And it's a classic protection racket, isn't it? Oh, Saudi Arabia, when the Americans came. Lovely country, they say to the ruling family. It's very peaceful at the moment, isn't it? It would be a shame if there would be some revolt and some regime change, wouldn't it? I mean, the whole country could be up in arms. There could be some civil war. Well, we want to prevent that. Look, we're putting our troops here to prevent that. And we'll give you peace and stability. But of course, this is very costly, and we need some cooperation with you concerning a minor financial matter, namely sell your oil only against the US dollar. And because then you'll get billions and billions of US dollars, you must buy US treasuries to the tune of 80% of your foreign exchange reserves has to be US treasury. So when they did this deal, then that solved two problems. It created massive demand for the dollar. Now Germany and Japan needed to see how they can get US dollars, because to buy oil, they needed dollars. And secondly, by the way, this same trick is what President Putin used last year when the ruble fell significantly, and then he wanted to shore up the ruble, and he announced that the ruble, the oil, the gas will only be sold, Russian gas will only be sold against the ruble, and suddenly the ruble dramatically shot up. So the same mechanism. And so that problem was solved. So the dollar was now stabilized and hence came to be known as the petrodollar. But also the other problem of the, because it was a twin deficit, the fiscal budget, government budget deficit, which is huge due to the military operations, the covert operations, the global, you know, interventions and regime changes and, you know, paying for assassins and all that, you know, it's all very expensive. So, that was also solved, you know, all these off-budget items, because Saudi Arabia was now plowing 80% of its foreign exchange reserves back into U.S. treasuries, and the treasury market came to be dominated by Saudi Arabia. By the way, they rigged the figures. The statistics went up to show that Saudi Arabia was the biggest buyer. So until the 80s, when Japan took over, this was kept well hidden in the breakdown of the statistics. They created the bigger category of Middle Eastern investors and then sort of was subsumed there. So that was what they did. So really the inflation was caused by the Fed in order to help the dollar survive by inflating other currencies. And secondly, in order to have the space where they could arrange a new international monetary system and move from the old, which was the gold dollar, to the petrodollar. Now, my argument is exactly the same has been happening since 2020. Exactly the same. The official story they tell us is the same. Oh, there's a war. Oh, because of the war, there's now an energy embargo. There's now less deliveries of gas and oil. Of course, it was self-imposed under U.S. instructions. Europe had to say, we're not buying from Russia. We're reducing buy from Russia, shooting themselves in the foot. Be that as it may, they suddenly had these artificial embargoes on energy. And then, of course, energy prices go up, and that's why we have inflation. Well, it's not true again. And again, they got the timing wrong, because the inflation happened before the war started in February 2022. The inflation was already very significant, just like in the 70s, where it was the massive credit creation in Germany, Japan, all these countries, which happened in 71, 72, which explains the inflation peaking in 73. And the same, you know, I asked you, in May 2020, I was on Twitter, you know, Scientific Econ and Professor Werner, the two accounts, and I had the latest data from the Fed, and I went on the record warning that there will be significant inflation now. Significant inflation, i.e. double-digit inflation, which was, you know, people thought I was crazy. And my argument was very, very simple. There was a massive monetary expansion
by the Fed
in 2020, March. And actually, we'll have to discuss this. It's a very particular type of QE they did, which I proposed originally in Japan in 95, and which so far they had not adopted, but I'd urged Japan to take when they had deflation, because it's a way of very quickly getting out of deflation and having an expansion. Sure. But they did it when there was no deflation, there was no contraction. In fact, they had restricted supply. This is like the totally opposite situation, totally wrong time to do it, but they did it. And that's why I was forecasting inflation. Was war part of my forecast? No, not at all. Absolutely not. No consideration concerning energy prices, gas, oil, at all. So that wasn't a factor. This inflation that we've had was entirely created. And I'll now tell you the details of how this was done. Because it all started in August 2019. That's when the inflation was being planned. And there was a meeting where this was, the plan was announced. This was the Jackson Hole Conference of central bankers in America, the Federal Reserve being well presented. And specifically, it was a presentation by BlackRock. BlackRock presented the plan that, first of all, they said, they just asserted, the next crisis will come. Point number two, when the next crisis comes, and that'll be soon, we must create inflation.
They
didn't really explain, you know, why they were sure there was a crisis. They didn't say why we have to create inflation. And nobody seemed to question it. Oh, okay, we must create inflation.
You're just very well informed about the future.
The biggest asset manager in the world, BlackRock, having what, trillions and trillions of assets under management, says next time we must create inflation. Oh, then it must be true. So, and then they explain how to
go
create
on
inflation.
It was the repo market debacle that came very shortly after that. I don't know if you're going to include that in your explanation, because you had August and then October 19. That was that liquidity. Can you tie that in?
Well, it's hard to prove, but it's possible that that was already the first step. It's hard to really be sure why suddenly the repo interest rates spiked so significantly. So something was happening. Some people say it was engineered as the, you know, essentially they've decided, okay, the next crisis will happen, so let's get going. So, and then JP Morgan apparently had a big role in being involved in the mechanics there behind this spike in the repo rate. So potentially it was intentional. Of course, there's the alternative hypothesis that something was going badly wrong, and they needed to respond to it, and they therefore said, okay, that BlackRock plan will have to move towards implementing. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. So we don't really need it as an explanation, which is why I don't usually spend too much time on it.
Okay.
But the intriguing thing is that this plan announced by BlackRock. Now, what was the plan? They referred to my proposal from Japan in 1995, I proposed quantitative easing, a new monetary policy for a post-banking crisis situation and recession. And I recommended two steps. I call it QE1 and QE2. So QE1 was the very immediate and simple measure that, because the cause of the banking crisis is non-performing assets in the banking system. And it is kind of silly to allow a whole country to go into recession and have large-scale unemployment and dislocation just because some banks have a bit of an accounting problem. I mean, does that make sense? Well, these accounting problems can be solved. And that can be done very easily if the central bank purchases the non-performing assets of banks at face value. Problem solved. Cost to the taxpayer, zero. Cost to society, zero. So you can solve the non-performing asset problem in the banking system at zero cost at any time. And that was my first proposal. The central bank should do that. Buy the non-performing assets from banks. Keep it on the central bank balance sheet. Forget about it. Problem solved. But in Japan, the problem was so big. I mean, non-performing assets in the early 90s, when I was warning about that, that it will become a problem, and I was the only voice, everyone else was saying, oh no, it's great, buy Japanese stocks. I was saying, they're going to go bust since 91. Be warning that. And then I'd be making these estimates. The estimate was 25% of assets are non-performing, incipient assets, of course not officially announced, but the official story was different. So because it's so large, even when the central bank takes away those non-performing assets, you would still find that the bankers will be risk averse and will not increase lending. So you need a second measure. That's by QE2. And that one is a way for the central bank to plow money through the banking system into the economy. The central bank deals with banks. It doesn't normally deal directly with the economy. So it's via the banking system. How do you do that? It is for the central bank to purchase performing assets from non-banks. So again, QE1. Central bank purchases non-performing assets from banks. QE2, the central bank purchases performing assets from non-banks. When the central bank does that, and I gave the example in 95, 96, the bank of Japan should just buy land, real estate in Tokyo from the owners. Then the owners' accounts at the banks will be credited with the amount, which forces the banks to create that money as they get the instruction from the central bank to pay that person. That's bank credit creation forced by the central bank. And then you have Bank of Japan turn it into parks. There's not enough park space in Tokyo. You get all these BOJ parks in Tokyo. Quality of life improves. You've supported the real estate market and you pushed a whole lot of money straight into the economy. Very effective and quick measure. Of course, you can use financial instruments, corporate bonds, which is what the Fed and Europeans did in 2020. So that was my proposal. And I was shocked to find that this is what... So QE1 was implemented by Ben Bernanke in 2008, which is why it still took 2 years for bad credit to recover. That is exactly my analysis. That alone is great. It will make the banks, the big banks, were bailed out through that. Non-performing assets bought up by the Fed. Other central banks, by the way, didn't do it, which is why their recessions lasted long. America was the first to recover because the Fed adopted my Bernanke. It was part of these debates in the 90s when I made this proposal, and he listened carefully and adopted that, but only QE1. So in 2020, they adopted QE2. The Federal Reserve bought assets from the non-bank sector, from the corporate sector, from the economy, and therefore, and in fact, we're talking huge amounts, hundreds of billions, trillions, and sent the instruction, of course, to the banks. So the banks received reserves from the central bank and credited the sellers' accounts at the banks, which created new deposits. And that explained this massive simultaneous expansion in central bank and bank credit in March 2020. Unprecedented. Now, that's a very unusual policy. In fact, the Bank of Japan until then had even argued, we can't do this, what Professor Werner is saying is impossible. We never do this. But suddenly, in March 2020, all the central banks knew exactly how to do it, and they did it. They had done it. So they can't argue, oh, it was a mistake, or oh, it was a coincidence. I mean, this is such a rare policy. Central banks do it maybe once a century. Yeah. So, and they all did it at the same time in March 2020. So it's very clear this is highly coordinated, came from the Fed.
And
it was BlackRock's plan. It was exactly what BlackRock was announcing at that conference. Of course, it had to be inflationary because you're pumping money into the economy while at the same time restricting supply, and the fiscal measures were put in place to make sure there'd be a lot of consumer spending. Stimulus checks and so on. So it was very, very clear that it had to be inflationary, unavoidable. But it was the BlackRock question, you know.
It was also demand-driven because you're giving the surge, but it was also supply constriction because you bifurcated the world on the thesis of the Russia-Ukraine narrative as well.
The supply through all these Soviet-style restriction measures that they love and are increasingly implementing in Europe, you know, all the Sovietization, rationing and so on. Telling people, no, you can't do this and that. But how do we know this is the BlackRock plan? Well, BlackRock had said so, that it needs to be done. But I think they were not satisfied with it. They didn't want conspiracy theories suggesting only that it could have been BlackRock that's behind this. No. In order to preempt that, the Federal Reserve hired BlackRock to implement it. So now we know it was... 100%. I mean, we got the smoking gun. It fits the BlackRock proposal, but they actually made sure to hire officially. You can see it, the announcement. They hired BlackRock. And the Fed logic was, well, we're central bankers. We don't dirty our fingers by dealing with non-banks. So BlackRock, you guys, okay, you know, you do that. I mean, that's a whole lot of assets to buy. We give you instructions. You do it using our money. You know, they were the managers that were instructed to implement this Fed policy. And that's totally official. So you know for sure it isn't that BlackRock plan.
As you grab a breath, and what amazed me is that the US government had hired BlackRock to negotiate Argentina's repurposing of debt when they had their last crisis. So essentially, the IMF stroke, largely American-backed, were utilizing. These guys are a quasi-super trans-governmental agency or intermediary for yes. all things financial and restructuring. I mean, we've never had essentially what's meant to be a commercial private asset manager actually assume status roles with authority of governments and central banks as their proxy. It's unbelievable to me where we've got to with this.
Must be great calling for Goldman Sachs. Because, of course, in the earlier era before BlackRock, the same was, you know, Goldman Sachs had that role. BlackRock accumulated all these assets and then suddenly became, you know, just a whole dimension larger. And now I think we should run some statistical tests for statistical causality to test the hypothesis. So first hypothesis would be the U.S. government instructs BlackRock to do the Argentinian deal. The Federal Reserve instructs BlackRock to buy those assets. But the alternative hypothesis, of course, is BlackRock instructs the Fed to do this.
That's the real power.
Instructs the government to negotiate with Argentina.
Yeah.
And he will implement it on their behalf.
You will hire, do this. it's fascinating. Can I just, we've done such a good basing. I want to bring it now into the future a little bit and be forward looking. But can you touch on, so we've had the BRICS and the Saudis showing interest in the invitation, but not immediately overtly accepting. Is this all part of, yes, they definitely are going to be doing the mating dance, but they're pretending not to immediately fall in love to not upset the petrodollar thing. So they're giving it time to sort of fall out of love in one area, fall in love another way. Is this a political mating dance? And then also so that whole, I suppose, the bifurcation with BRICS and who's behind that, how you see that ending. And then looking forward in terms of debt, how should people be preparing? So maybe I'll let you respond just on the Saudi, but the forward looking, given all that we understand, what should we be expecting for the future? It's without being a nihilist, as I'm sometimes accused of being, it looks bleak. There's a real debt issue that's going to have to be taken. And you're already seeing BlackRock and everyone else applying for Bitcoin ETFs, the CBDCs, the new money. So how, all with all you've learned, and if you start swinging your telescope into the future, bring us into your Richard Werner's take on what lies ahead for us.
Yes, well, the analogy with the 70s continues to be useful. So we had Kissinger in Saudi Arabia. We also had Kissinger in 71 going to China. And Saudi Arabia was key for the petrodollar. Well, Saudi Arabia has just in the last few years switch. It was a slightly gradual process, but essentially it's complete. Saudi Arabia switched from the US to China. It's just now formally joined BRICS. It's already been before listing the UN denominated oil futures on the Shanghai Futures Exchange. So essentially we now have oil deliveries in Chinese currencies, not US currencies. And funny enough, Henry Kissinger has just been to China.
Yes, at 100 years old.
At this age of 100 years old. So, yes, the indication seems to be it is like the 70s. And the 70s was about shoring up U.S. power and maintaining U.S. control via the U.S. dollar. And secondly, inflation was part of that. And secondly, the inflation was to cover up this period where you switched the new system, which was the petrodollar. And in many ways, this still applies, despite what's happening with the BRICS countries, because what is that new system? What is the new currency? What is the successor to the petrodollar? Well, that was also announced at the same conference in August 2019 and in Jackson Hole. It was the other relevant speech was by one of my fellow students at Oxford in the MPhil economics at the time, Mark Carney, who, you know, then moved to back office Goldman Sachs. So it's sort of the old generation financial players. And Mark Carney's speech was about the new international monetary system. And he said that, well, what follows the petrodollar, and paraphrasing, obviously, but he said it's going to be CBDCs, central bank digital currencies, that are linked to each other. Now, at the G20 meeting, it looks like and it was, you know, there's BRICS countries there. It looks like it was announced that, hey, yes, let's have CBDCs, and we can also link them to each other. India, of course, announced it, and India is very advanced with the digital control grid, with its Aadhaar system introduced by Infosys, run by the father-in-law of Rishi Sunak, who is the currently holding the position of a prime minister of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland. So that seems to be sort of the plot, and certainly the G20, but possibly the BRICS countries are actually part of that plot. They seem to agree that is the way to go. We know the Russian Central Bank has been working on its CBDC. We know China already has a CBDC. So that seems to be the common agreement, which leaves us ordinary people wondering what we should do and how we should react to this. Because, yes, there will be a new system based on digital control, which, of course, the central planners love. I mean, think about it. This is like the dream come true for central planners. Central planners love the Soviet Union. And it's always, when you're wondering now, there's a new government announcement. What does this mean? What does that mean? Just shortcut, think of Soviet Union. You quickly understand what's going on.
There's a more technological
problem and telling people what to do. Sorry, yes.
Yeah, and the totally more technological as well. The control is so digitally strong. We've got the tech. It's a surveillance system.
Yes, and just to give an example, I mean, look at the car industry. And it is, you know, the underlying attack on Germany, Japan from the 70s is still there. I mean, the Americans are still working on that, because despite this transfer of wealth in the 70s, you know, it was America. I mean, imagine, it was America forcing the Saudi Arabian to quadruple the oil price and therefore massively transferring wealth from Japan and Germany and Europe to the US via Saudi Arabia. It was a US policy. Of course, the official story was, oh, this is something that happened. There was a war and bad things happened. And sorry, guys in Europe, you know. But it was a raid. It was a shakedown of Europe. And that continues because, of course, the strength of these countries has been the automobile industry, which, you know, because it's so multifaceted, there's so many jobs connected to it. And it had been a long-term goal to shake that down as well. And so now the new plans under the whole climate change agenda seem to be to move to a Soviet system. And what do I mean with that? Well, you see, the Soviet Union had cars. Oh, yes, but of course, ordinary people didn't use cars. No. You had to be a Politburo member and member of the cadre of the Communist Party, you know, in order to get the permission to have a car. And the rest was using public transport. That's what is being planned for us. So individual car use is going to be suppressed. We know this for sure because this entire drive to switch to electric cars is a complete smokescreen, because anyone can calculate very quickly that it is impossible to switch all cars to electric engines. You know, it's impossible. Number one, there's not enough electricity being generated. And number two, we do not have enough components, inputs, raw materials for the batteries to build enough batteries to have even enough electric cars. So we won't have enough electric cars, and we won't have enough electricity to make this possible. Therefore, you know, it cannot happen. It will not happen. So what is the real plan? Well, it is a bait and switch strategy. Oh, electric cars, that's the woke thing to do. That's the good thing to do. Do it for humanity. Do it for the planet. And then, of course, turns out it's all very expensive and cumbersome, while at the same time, they make driving less and less attractive. You know, everyone's stepping up the speeding ticket regime, the parking ticket regime, less and less parking in the cities. You get new zones where you have to pay extra charges for a car, like the London Euless zone and all that. And then at some stage, it will be clear, oh, actually, no cars for anyone.
I've been saying the same for airlines, Richard. Sorry to come in here, but I've been saying the same for the whole concept of discount airlines for retail, for their, you know, the Brits to go for their Spain or Canaries Islands trip. Surely this, do you not see the very much the same thing, the short haul being squeezed, the cheap short haul?
Yes, indeed. Yes, yeah. I think it's the same. So really it's about restricting movement. And we see this with this 15-minute city drive and other various ridiculous proposals from the World Economic Forum to essentially have people in digital prisons where they're not allowed to move. I mean, ideally, they'd like us locked into cities in our digital prison where we're 100% under control and surveillance, and we just serve to be harvested as suppliers of information on what we're doing, on our lives, our thinking, our, you know, every click is monitored. That's the goal. So we have to do the opposite. We have to become local, be out of the cities, try to be self-sufficient, help form communities with farms and farmers, and be off-grid as much as possible, and also think about alternative monetary systems, you know, use of gold and silver, cash, use of cash, of course. Now we should always insist as much as possible. And we should establish decentralized monetary systems by establishing community banks. And they can be a center for the creation of alternative local currencies. There's a small number of projects I'm working on at the moment to establish community banks. And there's also two or three banks, small banks up for sale I'm trying to buy at the moment. So if any of your readers is interested in becoming a shareholder in the bank, a community bank or otherwise, it's very profitable, get in touch with me. You can be part of this. I think there's a lot we can do.
That sounds very, very interesting. I'm in Southern Africa at the moment. Two interesting parallels for you as a bit of data, because you might not get a lot of South African news. There's a state called Oranje, where the original Boers just wanted land for themselves and their own culture. And they've created their own currency and accept it in their own stores. And they've created sort of a farmer on the river, and it's expanding. And there's actually quite a lot of people with neighboring farms that are adopting the same strategy, although they're not part of Oranje, because that way they get around, you know, the fact that essentially it's made for one community, which if it could be always framed as racism if you're unlucky. So that they're doing that. And the other interesting point is on the energy side, the Eskom provider is going bankrupt. It's been totally, it was status. South Africa used to export electricity to the whole of Southern Africa many, many years ago. It's now been essentially run down, under-maintained, etc. So I'm pretty sure someone's going to Phoenix buy all these assets when they're done breaking it. But the interesting thing on people that have gone off-grid is if you have services that are there, even if you don't use them, they now insist on charging you for the non-use of them. So they can't provide you full services. They have shutdowns every day, stage six, you know, it means certain number of hours where they're not providing power. But if you do go independent, they now actually charge you for the fact that you are removing yourself as a client as well. So the statism and the cheek of a decaying business structure and the need to keep extracting from people, even when they manage to circumvent using you, because A, you're unreliable, B, you can't fully provide the service, C, you actually get levied with a charge as well. So that is Bolshevik communism, if ever you want it. Heads, they win, and tails, you lose type scenario. So yeah, interesting little point for you. What about the debt system, Richard? They've managed to keep these plates up in the air for far longer than any of us have ever expected. And I mean, we're talking right now today, and silver's absolutely being smashed down in an environment where oil is actually going up. And debt, the state of debt, I mean, I'm a bear debt. And Japan as well, Japanese debt as well, but American debt is probably the most indebted, but they still have the privilege. So we've been long dollar against the yen. There's a lot of thematic macro trades. We're short TLT, which is the great all of this. How, in the final 5 minutes before we wrap, How should people position? Are there any macro trades that you see economically, things that almost have to happen?
There's two things. What I just said was strategies which are medium to long run strategies, and they're really designed to survive rather than maximize your short term profits and trading. I think there's a lot of trading one can do in the short term. But even in a system that's overall going down, there's still a lot of, you know, clearly there's a lot of volatility, and therefore a lot of profits can be made as short-term trader if you have the time to follow carefully and move in and out. And I do follow the credit creation in 38 countries in the world. I've got a report, Liquidity Watch report, on that, which you know, has forecasts for equity markets, bond markets, and currencies, because they're largely function of the relative credit creation in these countries, central bank and bank credit creation. But where am I currently positioned? Certainly the U.S. equity market has become very expensive, while at the same time credit creation has fallen. That indicates there could be a sell-off, as quite a few people, of course, are warning from, you know, later September or October, which is traditionally a time when there could be corrections like this. That's definitely possible. The stock market clearly is quite artificial. You have some very, very big players that can push it up and keep it up, even when fundamentals and credit creation is the most important fundamentals say otherwise. So that's one issue, that while we're in this late stage of a system that is ultimately going to collapse and be replaced with a new system, the manipulations also get bigger, the dislocations get bigger, and therefore it's almost as if, you have to be more careful now with fundamentals. You can't just rely on fundamentals because of these manipulations. So that means that you have to place a bit more emphasis on the essentially short-term technical analysis driven trades. That would be one recommendation. And otherwise, some fundamental, some industries that are well positioned for the long run, one could probably hold, you know, long-term stakes, equity stakes. Inflation could still get a second bout. It's not clear yet. We haven't had that data yet. But so far, the template of the 70s has worked very well. And that time, they had the first bout, then inflation came down. Then they engineered the second expansion in credit creation and inflation again. So that's something to keep in mind. Some people are now saying, okay, it could be actually even deflation, which is true. They don't have to copy the 70s template. It's still on the cards. But again, we don't fully have the data to forecast deflation. So we're in between at the moment. We'll have to keep eyes open and be aware that the manipulations continue. But it's important to keep in mind these bigger stories because they indicate the goals of the manipulators, the central planners, the central banks.
Excellent. Richard, we've taken a lot of your time and we truly appreciate it. I would recommend that everyone purchase The Princess of the End, not only for understanding the history, but also for understanding what's coming. It's a very useful template for going forward. Your publisher for buying direct from you rather than making money for the likes of Amazon is quantumpublishers.com, www.quantumpublishers.com. We will put the links below. We suggest the purchase of the book there. And also for following on Twitter, if you will give us your two favored Twitter profiles.
Yes, Scientific Econ, because in terms of economics, I'm always asked, what is your school of thought? Well, I'm using scientific methods in economics. Very few people do that. So that's one, Scientific Econ. The other one is Professor Werner.
And that's Professor, remember, with two S's, one F, and W-E-R-N-E-R. At Professor Werner. Again, in the there. An absolute must follow on both those profiles. Go and check out Richard's Princes of the Yen book on quantumpublishers.com. Richard, thank you very much for your time and your insights. I'd love to do this again sometime in the future.
Excellent, Franz. Good talking to you. Take care. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's great, Richard.